Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. It's Friday, July the 18th, 2003. On this date in 1925, the first volume of Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf was published. Today on the Journal, meet one of our state's best-selling authors, Dorothea Benton Frank. We'll talk about her newest novel, Isle of Palms, which has already hit the New York Times bestseller list. It's a story about the complexities of modern families that Pat Conroy describes as hilarious and wise. Dottie is a lot of fun to talk with, and I'm sure you'll appreciate her wit and southern charm. I'll also talk with producer Tony Tackerberry about the History Detectives series. An upcoming episode investigates South Carolina's Beech Island Agricultural Club to see if they've uncovered the original signed copy of Robert E. Lee's farewell address in their archives. That's next on Walter Edgar's Journal, right after this news. Thanks for joining me on Walter Edgar's Journal. Last week, with the help of our friends at the Open Book and Litchfield Books, we did a rundown of what South Carolinians were buying and reading in June. Isle of Palms ranked second in Polly's Island and third in Greenville. It's Dorothea Benton Frank's debut hardcover novel, and it has a real Lowcountry feel and the same southern charm as her first two books, Sullivan's Island and Plantation. I sat down with Dottie when she was in town last week to discuss Isle of Palms and her southern roots, which laid the groundwork for so much of her writing. First of all, Dottie, welcome back to South Carolina, welcome back home, and welcome to the Journal.
Walter, you're going to make me cry. Thank you. Thank you. I always love to be here.
Now, one thing I know that you've really hit the big time is that your name is larger than the title on the book.
That scared me to death. The first thing I asked them to do is to make my name smaller, because everybody's heard of the Isle of Palms, but no one's ever heard of me. So, you know, I was embarrassed. They were like, you're so stupid. You don't know. This is how you do it. I'm like, all right, well, whatever. Anyway.
Well, it's clear from Isle of Palms and your other two books that you're mining your childhood here in South Carolina, growing up on Sullivan's Island.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Dottie Frank growing up on a different Sullivan's Island. You know, I know you're fighting gentrification now, but
with a vengeance.
But the whole Carolina coast is changing almost literally every day.
It is. Growing up on Sullivan's Island was a very sort of, you know, humble, very, very innocent childhood that we had. My brothers and my sister and I, we were the children of World War II veteran. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm a boomer. I was born in 1951, and my father came back from the war in 1946. And he then died in 1955 at the age of 41, which was pretty traumatic. But anyway, all of Sullivan's Island at that time was filled with families whose fathers had just returned from the war. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, even though it was kind of a sleepy little island off the coast, and even though we were just, you know, little geeky brats mm-hmm. running around picking blackberries during the day, we had a very sort of free, almost mythical childhood, you know, for the freedom that we had. I mean, children today just don't have that at all. But that's where Sullivan's Island was born. The story of Sullivan's Island, I kept going back and back and back to the beginning to try to remember what it was like. And then I remembered how many other large families there were like mine on Sullivan's Island, all of whom had a wonderful woman who was descended from the Gullah culture and from slavery, you know, who really sort of kept us in line and kept our fathers in line. And that's what Sullivan's Island's all about, the first book.
Well, in Isle of Palms, of course, you have a very strong character, Miss Angel.
Isn't she great? I love her.
Yes, I do too. I like her for her earthy wisdom.
Yeah.
And for the way she basically controls everything.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's how it was. The woman who raised me was a woman named Ella Wright, to whom Sullivan's Island is actually dedicated. And, you know, she really took all of us in hand and took no fool from anybody. I mean, you know, and by the time we were 4 or 5 years old, we all knew exactly where we belonged in our house and in every social situation and how we were supposed to behave. And if we didn't behave, I mean, she, you know, read us a riot act. I mean, no problem. No problem at all.
And didn't think twice about it.
Not at all. Thank God. I mean, if not for her, I can only imagine how dysfunctional all these families really would have been. Mm-hmm. You know, these were wonderful women.
Well, your love affair, and I think it is your love affair for the Carolina coast, for the islands, is quite apparent. You've been living north of the Mason-Dixon line for part of your adult life.
It's killing me. I mean, you know, I have a wonderful life in New Jersey, you know, and I have a great husband and great children. I mean, you know, children have their issues. Raising children is a very difficult thing to do, obviously. But, I mean, it's as good as it could be. But still, I mean, my whole heart has always been here in South Carolina. It always will be.
Well, there are a couple of things, just touchstones for me, for somebody that reads the book, who understands and appreciates South Carolina and the Lowcountry. And you mentioned here, talking about from your protagonist, Anna Abbott, she says, "But we do love the history of the Lowcountry with a wild passion, and we romanticize it all, telling ourselves we are anything except ordinary because we can just call this place home."
That's right. But it's true.
It's true.
I mean, when you come from the Lowcountry of South Carolina, when you come from South Carolina at all, I think, because, I mean, there's certain things about the Lowcountry that are a little different than living in Columbia. I mean, Columbia is an urban area. And when I talk about the Lowcountry, I'm really talking about the beach areas and the old rice plantation areas where, you know, the living is a lot more laid back. But it is a very unique and special place to grow up in every way.
Oh, it is. And, of course, the Lowcountry is special, and it has been at least caught in fiction and the arts since the 1920s, since the Charleston Renaissance.
Right.
But you've got another phrase here about, "We have to live near the ocean to stay in touch with our souls. Everything is amplified. The breeze is sweeter, the air is thicker, the sun is relentless, and the nights are more mysterious. God's fingerprints are all over it."
They are.
I wish you had written Isle of Palms before I had done my history, because I might have included that instead of Pat Conroy's.
Oh, my Lord, don't say that about Pat. He'll like, you know.
I like Pat's too, but what I've tried to do with contemporary fiction, and I quote from Joe Humphreys as well.
I love Joe Humphreys' work, too.
Is it how people who write about contemporary South Carolina are so much in love with the place?
Oh, how can you not be? You know, the other night, the 4th of July, I was on Sullivan's Island with my family, and the fireworks went off at the Hill Fort. And just by some stroke of luck, we've bought this house on the marsh, sort of a block off the marsh, but it was almost like the fireworks were going off in our yard, and they were just for us. And afterwards, there were a billion stars in the sky, and I looked at Peter, my husband, and I said, "Look at this, look at this. This is like another gift." It's another gift, you know. It's so beautiful. This morning I got up and I went outside to, you know, sort of closing my house up to leave to come up here. And the air was so thick. And I thought, oh, there goes my hair for the day. You know, I keep looking like Don King wherever I go. My hair just sort of rises up off my head in this great big Brillo pad. But anyway, you know, walked out this morning and I thought, yeah, but it's so warm. And the warmth is just, it's like being hugged. You know, when you walk outside, it's like the air just wraps itself around you. You know, everything makes itself known with such velocity. It's wonderful.
Well, it does. And even in Columbia, in the early evening now, about 6 o'clock when the air gets still, and the perfume of the 4 o'clock and the honeysuckle, you feel like you can put your hand in front of it to just move the air so that you can...
You want to scoop it up and just put it all over yourself. You know, it's wonderful.
And those folks who are fortunate enough to be in the mountains talk about the crystal clean air with the scent of the pine. So
no, this is a magical place. I mean, the Southeast has, you know, people, there's this great argument going on about whether or not we really are, you know, quote, Southern writers versus American writers. But you know me, Edgar. I mean, I'm just glad to be considered a writer, you know, in general. But being a Southern writer, I mean, my God, I can't imagine a greater distinction.
Well, it's interesting. Pat Conroy and I had this same conversation about 6 weeks ago. And, of course, the academics love to debate whether or not there's such a thing as Southern fiction today. And, of course, Walker Percy disdained being called a Southern writer, except he very much was.
No kidding, a Southern writer. That's right. No kidding.
But somehow they felt they were demeaned by being Southern writers. That's baloney.
It's complete baloney, because this is one of the few places left in this country that really has its own identity. And more than that, it's the history of this place that's so haunted. And it's the weather and the nature that surrounds us that's so powerful. I'm sorry. I'll be a Southern writer anytime you can call me a Southern writer. I think it's a great compliment.
Well, I think given the way you started off with your titles, obviously drawing on South Carolina, and given the place names that we have along the coast, ma'am, you could be writing for the next 20 years and not run out of anything. You know, you've already mentioned that maybe you'll have one, Shems Creek. You could have Bulls Bay. You could have McClellanville.
That's right. Louise. That's right. Goat Island. I'll just be moving up and down the coast.
And you just said something in Beaufort. Beaufort's a very special place,
too. I love Beaufort. I was just there. Oh, God. What a gorgeous little jewel of a town Beaufort is. Don't tell anybody, though, okay?
Well, unfortunately, it's been discovered. Like Charleston has been discovered.
Yeah.
And Charleston is suffering because of it being discovered. You know, Joe gets very upset about, you know, she has that scene in Rich and Love about the tour buses expelling their diesel fumes and disgorging, you know, thousands of tourists to climb over the walls and what have you. She said her Charleston is being lost.
I don't know. I mean, Joe and I had a great discussion once on Sullivan's Island about when they have the 4th of July parade one year that we'll get a convertible car and we'll decorate it with all kinds of big signs that say stop gentrification and kill your landscaper and, you know, kill your, you know, sprinkler system and all of this. We would like it to go back to the island where there was a thicket that you had to cut your way through to go and have some adventure as a child. But that's also sort of mourning the loss of your own childhood, right?
But hey, those thickets are worth so much per square foot, you can't just let them stay vacant anymore.
That's right. No, you can't.
But now, speaking of killing your landscaper, your heroine, or your protagonist, don't want to be old-fashioned here, your heroine, Anna Abbott, is a fabulous gardener. And
I love to garden.
And, of course, here in South Carolina, you can stick something in the ground and just about it'll grow.
Pretty much, right?
If you take care of it.
That's right. Sometimes you don't even have to. Sometimes benign neglect just takes over and, you know, the thing goes like crazy. I mean, I just put in 4 big Confederate jasmine plants, oh, I guess 2 months ago, and they're already double the size they were. It's incredible. And rosemary, oh my Lord, my rosemary, these little plants I put in 2 years ago are now these huge hedges. So.
Well, rosemary, or she grows a Cherokee rose, and I can guarantee you, if you don't whack that thing back, it will take over the world.
That's right. That's right. Like cockroaches and Cherokee rose, right?
I prefer the, even though they stick, I prefer the Cherokee rose any day.
I'm with you. I'm with you.
All right, let's talk about Isle of Palms. What's the genesis for Isle of Palms?
It's about single people.
Okay. It's also about coming to grips with some unpleasantness in the past.
That's right. We all have our ghosts.
And it's also, I think, how different generations deal with the same problem.
Well, it's that, and it's also that, if you think about it for a second, everyone in this book is single. Mm-hmm. No one has a traditional marriage. No one really has these traditional relationships that we're all sort of made to believe that we're going to grow up to have. I mean, you grow up and get married, have 2 children, you stay married for 40 years, somebody drops dead, that's it. Well, that doesn't happen. I mean, people get married, half of them get divorced. All right, so there's that population. Then there's another population of people who never marry because they have made certain lifestyle choices, like their career takes over their life and they just never get around to thinking about a personal life for themselves. So if that's how society is today, and I believe a great deal of our society is, and we don't talk about that because we're still very couple-oriented socially, you know, then your friendships become a great deal more important. And who is going to take care of old people, and who is going to see about your next-door neighbor, and what is your sense of responsibility in your community to your fellow man? So keeping up with your old friends, maintaining those relationships, and indeed nurturing your friendships, I think is more important now than it ever has been, because those may be the people who wind up taking you to the doctor, you know, when you start to lose your vision or whatever, you know, terrible thing befalls you, as medical science is going to have us live to be 120 years old,
God
right?
God forbid.
Yeah, amen. Amen.
This is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm chatting with Dorothea Benton Frank about her recently released novel, Isle of Palms. It's currently ranked 13th on the New York Times bestseller list. But, you know, that's one of the things that even in the South, things have changed. It used to be, I know my wife's family comes from a small town in South Carolina, and on one block in this small town, her grandparents lived, and on the other three corners, her parents on one corner and aunts and uncles on the other.
Well, that's no more.
That doesn't
exist
anymore.
That's no more. I mean, you know, you would love to go to your mother's house for Sunday dinner, but maybe your mother lives in Nashville.
That's right.
You know, so where are you going to go? Are you going to have a Sunday dinner or you're not? You know, if you want to have a Sunday dinner, you better figure it out. So maybe it's about your friends. Maybe it's about an older neighbor. Maybe that's the day of the week you take a couple of hours to go see about somebody and see how they're doing.
Well, one of the things that you deal with people here, they're all single, but they're all very different ages, and I think that's
right.
Important. I mean, you're dealing with 2 very elderly women.
I love
Miss Mavis and Miss
Aren't
Angel.
Aren't they great? I love Miss Mavis.
Yes, I have a wonderful you have her described here as, I marked it. She was just like a little old Carolina blue crab, and I knew what she was going to like. No, a door living next door to.
Right.
And she also is a little bit on the crabby side.
Very much a curmudgeon.
And
her hair gets caught in those oleanders, and she has to get her hair done on Tuesday, and it's got to last till next Tuesday, and that's it. You know? Right? That's right.
And then you've got some teenagers.
Right.
First-year college kids,
right.
18, 19 years old.
It just so happens I have a daughter who's going to be 18 in November, so I do draw on the personal experience.
But it's interesting how the young people keep an eye on the really older people.
Right.
Just from a distance.
Right.
Just from a distance. And then you've got everybody in between.
Right.
There are probably four or five, almost five generations of people in this book.
Well, that's what I like about this story, though, over Plantation in Sullivan's Island. I mean, I think that the characters in here, to me, seem to be very real people. And I think that each one of them carries a more equal load of the story on their shoulders than in Plantation or Sullivan's Island. Sullivan's Island was sort of my own little narcissistic experience, my big love letter to Sullivan's Island in my childhood. You know, and Plantation was really about the death of my mother and dealing with that and what that was like. But when I sat down to write this, I started thinking about other things, you know, and about, I have so many single friends, and so many of them, not all of them, I mean, most of them are very, very happy, but so many of them go through these long periods of real loneliness, you know, and some of this book is also about how people, I mean, they're all doing the best they can with the lot in life that they've been dealt, but they also compromise themselves a little bit because of their loneliness. I mean, Anna is willing to have this relationship with Arthur on his terms, which are not her terms, and she gets very busy trying to justify.
Yeah, I'll take it, no commitment.
Right, I'll take whatever you got, because whatever you got to give me is better than what I had, which was nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that that rings true for a lot of single people in society, and it's a shame. I mean, you know, if you had more of a sense of community, if you knew where you belonged and who you were was a little more clearly spelled out to yourself, maybe you wouldn't compromise so quickly.
Well, that's true.
People are lonely.
Which is probably why Anna takes so long to move out from underneath Daddy.
But the marvelous thing about Anna is that she realizes, and this is probably her most important lesson in this whole story, how much is enough. She says, you know, I only have one child, and I have a little house, and I have a small business, but it's enough.
Mm-hmm.
Most people don't know how much is enough. They keep going and keep trying to acquire more and more and do more and more. And, you know, sometimes it's important just to realize you've done all right. And also, I think that the, you know, societal definition of success is very screwed up. I mean, you don't have to have Bill Gates's money to be considered successful. I mean, what about nurses? I mean, these are people who heal, you know, and doctors. I mean, they're not always making a lot of money, and they're dedicated to doing, isn't that successful? I mean, teachers, you know, educators. I mean, this is, you know, it's a calling to do this. I mean, no one ever expects to become a multimillionaire, you know, when you become a school teacher, but you change lives. Isn't that successful?
It should be considered a measure of success, but I think you're right. You know, two generations ago, they would have thought that being a school teacher was very honorable. And
right, it is honorable.
But it's not as respected as it was when you and I were growing up.
Yeah.
I'm a little bit older than you are, not much, but a little bit older.
Oh, about 28 seconds.
No, I'm a little bit older than that. I was actually a war baby, so.
Okay, a little bit.
A little bit older.
You're old enough to be my older brother.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, you've got two characters in here that really aren't very nice.
Let's see, which ones would they be?
Granny and Miss Trixie.
Oh, isn't Trixie evil?
But I know people like Trixie.
I know lots of them. This is sort of my in-your-face to them. Okay.
Very superficial.
Yeah.
She almost has no real grounding in anything. She's just a very superficial, shallow, mean, nasty.
Mean-spirited, narrow-minded, judgmental.
Doesn't know how to love and probably has not been loved.
Right.
And the one person who loves her, she really rejects.
She rejects. And it's Jim who still, you know, all through the story says, well, you know, maybe I should come back and sort of keep an eye on her.
Yeah. His other siblings are all somewhere else.
Right. He has a brother.
Yeah, and his dad was running around the world playing bridge.
Right. Had a heart attack at the Conard Hotel.
As you said, had enough space to trump the world.
Right.
God, I'd love to have had that.
I would, too. I love to play bridge. Yeah. Yeah, then there's Violet. Oh, God, Violet, the grandmother. But Violet's not really a horrible person. Violet's just terrified of life.
Well, she has had a horrible life.
Yeah, she's had a horrible life.
And, in fact, it's more in what you don't say. I mean, I happen to know that part of the world where she comes from.
Right.
And, you know, reading between the lines, I mean, literally God knows what she witnessed as a child.
Well, this is my mother-in-law and father-in-law's story because, you know, my husband was born in a relocation camp in Augsburg, Germany, after World War II, where his older brother actually died of starvation. And his parents immigrated to the United States through Australia and Sri Lanka, and arrived in Detroit in 1957. and the things they went through. I mean, my mother-in-law has told me these incredible stories about, you know, how her parents were sentenced to death twice because they refused to join the Nazi Party once, and the second time because they were suspected of running a newspaper for the resistance in the basement of their home, which they did. And they witnessed, you know, I mean, horrific things that even to this day, for her to even start to talk about it, she starts to weep. But my mother-in-law is a wonderful woman, you know, and she let me use some of her story for this book.
Well, what's interesting, I don't know if you know this, but I do know someone who is a German native who is about your mother-in-law's age, who does have a peach farm in Pembroke
County. No way.
Yes.
No way. Let's go see her. Oh, God. Isn't that funny?
And she is the mother-in-law of Tibby Steedley, who was my 20 years my administrative assistant at Southern
Edgar,
Studies.
That's so funny.
And she is a wonderful woman, but very German. And
really?
Yeah, a German housefrau.
Well, I promise I never knew that. The only thing I could think of is, you know, what were the most wonderful peaches I ever had in my life? And they were from Estill, South Carolina. I mean, they were just amazing peaches. And,
and you don't think of peaches that far down in the state, but they do grow that far.
Yeah, they do. They're wonderful.
Yeah. Well, this is a wonderful story, and I want to talk about it, but I don't want to give it away because it has a very interesting ending. Not quite an O. Henry ending, but you don't just wrap things up because they don't...
I'm not neat and tidy.
And how did you let that happen or make that happen?
I don't like perfect endings in stories that I read. I wanted this story to reflect real life. And when you read a story of mine, you're not looking at someone's entire experience. You're just looking at a segment of their life. And so you know that they go on and you know that they're all going to be all right. You're not sure quite how they're going to get there, but you have more hope for them at the end of the story than you did at the beginning, for sure. You know, everybody sort of finds their heart in this one, except for Trixie, who's horrible anyway. And Violet.
I don't think Trixie has a heart.
No, she doesn't. Living heart donor.
I think Violet probably did.
Yeah. She just had too much pain. She couldn't live anymore. It's like The Walking Dead.
But what she did to Anna as a child today would be considered child abuse.
Yeah, sure it would.
I guess I have known stern older people like that. Not quite as brutal, but...
It's her fearfulness, though, that makes her forgivable. If there's anything about her that's forgivable, is that you know she's just so afraid. She's so afraid all the time that doing one thing wrong, breaking one rule, making one step to the left is going to lead to a complete disaster. And it's simply not true, but that's what she thinks. You know, so she's hysterical all the time.
Yep. If Anna puts on lipstick, the next thing you know, she's going to be jumping into bed with somebody.
That's right, because lip gloss leads to sex.
I also enjoyed your depiction of the nuns at the school. Now, I'm not sure that modern-day sisters...
Actually, the nuns who taught me in grammar school and high school have since just about all left the convent except for two or three. And they'll call me up and they'll say, oh, I read this book. And, you know, we were never like that. And I say, yes, you were. And everybody laughs a lot. But that was the times, too. You know,
things were different back in the 50s.
They were, very much.
I did not go to parochial school, but I grew up in Mobile, which was a big Catholic town, and lots of my friends did. And, you know, sometimes you visit other schools, you know, and the sisters and their habits... I can't remember one without a ruler.
Right. They always had a ruler. In fact, I gave Pat Conroy one of these little wind-up nuns, this little fire-breathing nun. She's walking carrying a ruler. She's called Sister Godzilla. You know, I mean, she really, Nunzilla, something like that. It's very funny.
Well, to those who have a vocation out there, we're not poking fun.
Oh, heavens no.
But certainly there was an image, particularly from children who went to parochial school, and that's where we get these pictures.
That's right.
From kids who went there.
That's right.
But even those who...
I went to parochial school.
Yeah.
I witnessed plenty of whippings coming up in school. You know, but better than that was that we had no attention deficit disorder in Catholic school. No audio processing disorders. You know, the nun would get right up in your face and she would say, you listen when I'm talking to you, and then your audio processing disorder just went away. I mean, you know, she held you in rapt attention. It was my first, second, third, fourth, fifth grade classes. I believe we had 60 to 70 children in a classroom with one nun, okay? We sat in alphabetical order or else we sat organized by height.
After this news break on Walter Edgar's Journal, I'll continue my conversation with Dottie Frank about her newest novel, Isle of Palms. Plus, we'll discuss an upcoming episode of History Detectives, which investigates a South Carolina gentleman's club to see if they own the original copy of Robert E. Lee's farewell address. Welcome back to Walter Edgar's Journal. I'm talking with one of South Carolina's best-selling novelists, Dorothea Benton Frank. Her southern charm and Lowcountry heritage shine through in her newest book, Isle of Palms, which has already hit the New York Times bestseller list.
I went to Broke Hill School.
Yeah.
And there was no foolishness in our classroom at all. And we all learned how to write, and we all learned how to spell. We all learned parts of grammar, which is not taught today. You know, we didn't have any of this inventive spelling stuff going on, or, you know, nobody worried about stifling our creativity. You know, none of that.
And you could read.
Yeah, and we all came out of there, you know, reasonably literate.
Well, you came out very literate, because I love your
Walter,
imagery.
You seem so surprised.
No, I don't. No, I'm not surprised.
I know you thought you were, like, stuck with some girl's book that you had to read, right?
Well, see, that's another thing. I have this problem with people saying, that's a gal's book or a guy's book.
Right.
Now, I'll admit there may have been one or two books that I have read in the last few years that, yes, I would say they belong to one gender or another.
Right.
Secret Life of Bees is one of them.
Right.
And then you take things like W.E.B. Griffin and all of his stuff.
That's, yeah.
Those are guy books. But yeah. Most of the things, books should be read by
I think everybody. Everyone.
You know, did William Faulkner write boy books? I don't.
No,
so.
Absolutely not. You know, and did Wally Lamb write as Dolores in She's Come Undone, you know, because, you know, something wrong with Wally Lamb? I mean, Wally Lamb is a fabulous writer. He wrote as a woman. In fact, Shem Creek, I'm writing it as a guy. Mm. So my protagonist is a man. Mm. So why not? I mean, Arthur Golden, Memoirs of a Geisha.
Yeah.
I think these guys also know that women buy, you know, the vast majority of books that are sold. So it's like 65% or something. So
well, you get into Southern characterizations. I don't want to say stereotypes, but you get into Southern characterizations
right.
Twice. You define good old boys, bubbas, and rednecks.
Oh, isn't this cute? This is cute.
You also talk about a Southern woman's greatest way to control a man.
Well, of course.
You learned your lessons early. Maybe you had a postgraduate education from Florence King. I don't know.
You know, someone actually just gave me all of Florence King's books last year, year before last. I read them there. She is hilarious.
Southern ladies and gentlemen is hard to beat.
Oh.
But you say good old boys are the most traditional. Tell our listeners how you define a good old boy.
Well, Lord, honey, you got the text. I wrote this thing a year ago. Let me see. 2 years ago. Let's see. Good old boys were the most traditional. They polished their weejuns, monogrammed their shirts, smelled good, and held your door open. They were more worldly, could mix cocktails, may have gone to graduate school, where bubbas might have a truck for no particular reason. But they were nice guys who didn't get a lot of exercise, might get caught drinking beer for breakfast, and never walked away from a manly challenge. Rednecks never ate pork chops or chicken with anything but their hands, trained their Heinz 57 dogs to bite, occasionally hit their wives, used their trucks like a minivan to haul the kids around at tractor pulls, and provoked the manly challenges. That's men in good fun, though.
Well, it's men in good fun, and I think you will recognize characters in this book that fall into those categories. And, and you recognize people on the street. You recognize your neighbor that falls into those categories.
Sure. Well, I love good old boys, that's for sure. Grooming is important. ZZ Top says every woman loves a well-dressed man.
Well, except your heroine takes a while for her to learn how to dress well again.
Well, she's sort of depressed. She's kind of in a funk there. She's been working for Harriet for way too long. You know, Harriet's another lunatic in this book. You know, along comes Lucy, who you think is this giant lunatic, who isn't.
No.
You know, and this is all about, I mean, Lucy, I think, is a wonderful character because, you know, she's very classic female who's been told all of her life, you know, what a dope she is. And it turns out she's not at all.
The only thing, she can't cook.
She really can't cook.
If I'd been served that casserole, I think I probably would have.
the chicken and taco ship.
Yes.
In fact, it was Natalie Dupree. I saw her the other day, and she said, Lord, you know, there's a lot of food in your book. I just finished reading this book. It was wonderful. But what is with all this food? I said, Natalie, look at me. I'm hungry. You know, but what happens in your life, you know, if you're a woman, it happens. A lot of it happens around the dinner table and entertaining. So it's a great part of your life, having meals. Who's there? How you get it on the table?
Now, one thing you really didn't do that people might think, well, okay, that your heroine or protagonist is such an academic word.
It's all right.
Because she's a hairdresser, you might think, stereotypical hairdresser, she listens to the gossip and then runs around, but she really doesn't. She is not your typical salon operator,
well,
if there is such a thing.
I think that she probably is your typical salon operator. I mean, I interviewed probably, well, I don't know, maybe a dozen or more salon owners to write this book because I really wanted to try to get that right. And they are very serious business people. It's not like oh, what was the name of the salon in Steel Magnolias, where you go down there and everything is heard over the wash sink.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like that. I mean, it's a business, and it's a very competitive business, and, you know, people expect a certain level of professionalism when you go in, and gum chomping and all that sort of thing just doesn't go on anymore.
And it's no longer done in the back room of Miss Minnie's house.
Heavens no. No, people rent professional spaces, and they're small, and they outfit them like the inside of a little ship so that every square inch is used, and they go about their business, and, you know, it's a great world to be in, you know, world of service. I mean, isn't life all about service to others anyway? I mean, that's really, you know, the thing that makes you the happiest at the end of the day is when you do something for somebody else. You know, and Anna says she's just making people feel good about themselves, and if she can do that, that's fine.
And she does, given the happy clients she has, she does a good
job. I love when she says, you know, in the very beginning of the book, she says, you know, listen, I've got underutilized ears or whatever it is that I make this poor child say, you know, that if she started talking, you know, that gossip was for fools, that she'd be in the poorhouse if she started telling tales, right?
Well, if you start telling tales, pretty soon it'll get back. And
that's right.
Then you lose,
your
clients.
Credibility. Sure.
Now, you are a self-proclaimed Geechee girl.
I think I'm the real thing.
Oh, you are. And I didn't mean to say self-proclaimed is in doubt. But part of the mystique of the Lowcountry is a belief in something that might just be out there and you're not sure. And you've got a couple of really good accounts in your book of encounters with ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe in ghosts?
Oh, Walter, this is a deep question. You must have been up last night saying, well, should I ask her this on the air? No, I don't believe in ghosts, but I believe in spirits.
Okay.
I believe in spirits, and I believe that the people who love you never leave you. And I have seen many, many things on Sullivan's Island over the years that are completely inexplicable, and so have a lot of other people that I know. I think that when you live here and you live that close to nature, I do think you're a little step closer to God. At least you can hear and see signs of things more easily because your life is not cluttered with noise.
Well,
you know? And is the story about the mirror true? It's true.
Yeah.
It's true. I grew up in a house with a mirror like that.
It's riddled with stories from Beaufort to...
Because they're so.
But it's not just confined to the Lowcountry, although there are more there. You can go to almost any town in South Carolina and find stories of...
The Gray Man, Pawleys Island,
Gray Man,
the Somerville Light.
The young woman who hitches a ride down on the Bluff Road here to come into Columbia. By the time you get to Carolina Stadium, she's disappeared. You know, this sort of, I mean, they're just all sorts of stories.
I know they're so, okay? I can't explain them. And, you know, coming short of sounding like a screaming lunatic on your program and ruining my relationship with you. I mean, I tell you they're true.
Hey, look, Alan Greganis sat in that chair about a year ago and said, of course I believe in ghosts. He's got a ghost in his house up there in Hillsborough.
I've got ghosts in my house on Sullivan's Island and in New Jersey. If you believe such a thing as a Yankee ghost, I've got one.
Oh, I believe in Yankee ghosts or spirits because years ago when my wife...
See, they scare me.
I want to tell you, this is actually a true story. After my wife and I were first married and we, you know, gone beyond the graduate school stage, going to used furniture stores and what have you, and we bought this sideboard out of a New York estate.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as we brought it into the house... The secretary that we'd inherited from my grandmother began to groan and make noises.
Mm-hmm.
And so did the sideboard.
They were complaining.
But as soon as we were able to move up and get a real nice piece of furniture and sold the sideboard, the secretary has never said another peep.
Well, there you are.
You know, it's just,
very, I mean, what do you think that
people
is?
People say that's crazy. I said, look, the door would come open on the secretary.
Right.
I mean, it just
I'll tell you a great.
Happened.
I'll tell you a little story. It just happened to me. Just bought this house on Sullivan's Island. It's on Goldbug Avenue and Raven Drive. All right. Everybody knows Edgar Allan Poe used to live on Sullivan's Island. The name of my house is called the Rave Inn. Okay. I move in the very first night that I'm spending in this house alone. We had just painted a portion of the screened in, my whole porch is not screened in, just a part of it. Mm. And the painter left the door open so that it wouldn't dry and stick.
Mm-hmm.
I look outside, and what do you think is caught inside of my screen porch? A huge blackbird. Okay. I mean, this is, you know, you can't make this stuff up. The thing is banging against the screens, and the thing is going to tear up my screens, which is the thing I'm the most concerned about. So I call the police, and I call my cousin, and they come racing over there, and they get this broom. And the bird was huge. I mean, the thing must have been, no lie, it was this big.
A big crow? Or
big crow. maybe it was a raven. What's the difference between a raven and a crow? I don't know. But anyway, so they get the bird out of there. And no sooner than that, I run to the airport to pick up my son and then turn on the radio. And what's the first song that comes on the radio? Blackbird by Kenny G. I called my friend in New York. I said, you have to hear this. Somebody has to be a witness to this. So who is this a message from? Is Edgar Allan Poe sending me a message? I doubt it very seriously. But probably one of my crazy relatives wants to let me know that they're glad I'm back on Sullivan's Island. I mean, they've been dead for 100 years, whatever. But I believe those things. You know, it's a sign. I'm not sure what they mean, but that's too weird, isn't it?
It's too weird, but also it's what makes life fun.
Plus, there was no damage to my screens.
And you made the South Carolina top 10 list.
I did?
Well, we're now doing a survey of independent bookstores.
Oh!
You didn't beat out Harry Potter.
That's okay. That's like I would never expect to.
I must say, one of my favorite things is when HarperCollins released my book on the Revolution. It came out at the same time as Goblets of Fire. And in South Carolina, I was number two to Harry Potter. And I figured, if I can do number two to Harry Potter.
That's good, hey. Baby. That's good enough for me. I'll tell you, this whole Harry Potter thing is very interesting, too. I mean, what a phenomenon this is. You know?
Well, I was reading him before he became popular. I'm still... I put down...
Walter, you're so cutting edge. I mean, come on.
I put down number five to read Isle of Palms.
Bless your heart. I think it's great, though. You know, it's sort of like Oprah, you know, getting all these people to read John Steinbeck. I mean, this is a wonderful thing. You have people back in the bookstores again. Harry Potter comes up. People go to the bookstore. They buy a book for their child. They buy something for themselves. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good thing.
Well, let me tell you about one of my favorite bookstores. I don't know if you're scheduled to do anything at Litchfield Books, which is... a fabulous oasis there along the coast.
Yeah, I'm give me one second here. Sorry.
Dottie's schedule here is about an inch thick.
Oh, it's awful, isn't it? I'm at Litchfield Plantation at the Waccamaw Branch Library, Friends of the Library. Books being sold by Litchfield Books on Thursday, August 7th. Mm-hmm. That should be a lot of fun.
Yeah, it will be. And I've got a wonderful bookstore. But it gets not only... year-round people now because Litchfield's becoming a year-round place.
Right.
But it also gets a tourist trade.
Well, it's like Bay Street Traders in Beaufort.
Yeah.
Oh, my Lord, what a book signing I had there. It was crazy. Yeah. Sold every book, including the ones in the window.
Yeah.
It was great.
Well, the first week in June, they had a grand reopening, and Doug Marlette came down.
Oh, I love him. He's great.
Pat Conroy and Cassandra King.
Yeah.
And I signed, and Sister Peterkin, and we just had...
Oh, how wonderful.
Every one of us, each of us did a different day.
Sure.
And it was just a fabulous mix of folks.
Oh, how exciting. Well, I'm looking forward to going there in August.
All right, you were at Bay Street Books and you sold every book available. What were people saying about your book? Had any of them read it yet? Or
some of them had, actually. Some people brought books that they had bought somewhere else for me to sign. But most people, when they come to a book signing, say, I read your book in 2 days. When's the next one? Mm-hmm. And they don't understand that I have to write the book 10 times so that they can read it in 2 days, mm-hmm. You know, and I wish I could write. But that's mostly what people say. Or they say, you know, this character in the book is just like my grandmother, or this character is just like my ex-husband, or, you know, I actually did do this thing with a toothbrush that you suggested. It's very personal. Yeah, I think maybe because I write in first person, too, it's very immediate, and people feel like I'm talking to them, mm-hmm. which I am. I mean, I'm just telling you a story. Mm-hmm. You know,
well, that's what we Southerners do very well, is tell stories.
A lot of fun, yeah. It is a lot of fun.
Well, Dottie, we're about to run out of time.
Is there anything you'd like to...
Well, you've also got a book signing scheduled. Is there anything you'd like to share with our listeners before we sign off?
You know, I'm just so grateful for the support of everybody in South Carolina and all these wonderful people that, you know, that I know anything that anyone wants to hear is astonishing to me, but that someone would actually spend money to buy a book of mine and then read it and enjoy it is the most profound thrill ever. I mean, at my age, to have this happen to me, it's so exciting, and it's so, and book people are so nice. You know, it's a really wonderful universe to be in. I'm just grateful. That's all.
Well, I want to thank you for continuing to write about South Carolina, and for those who still got some beach time left, I can't think of anything better than sit on a screen porch with an iced beverage of choice and read Isle of Palms.
Thank you, Edgar.
Dottie Frank, author of Isle of Palms, Dorothea Benton Frank.
Lord of mercy.
Thank you for being with us today on the Journal.
It's a great pleasure.
History Detectives is a new series that strips away the myths and legends surrounding historic sites and artifacts to determine their authenticity. In an upcoming episode, the investigators turn their attention to the South Carolina Beech Island Agricultural Club to see if a document which has sat in their archives for over 120 years may be the signed copy of Confederate General Robert E. Lee's farewell address. I spoke with Tony Tackerberry, the episode's producer, about this local connection. First of all, Tony, welcome to the Journal.
Thank you very much.
Tell us about the process of investigating as to whether or not this document in possession of the Beech Island Farmers Club is the real thing or not.
I'd be happy to. I suppose the first thing to say is that I'm afraid I'm not able to tell you what we find out in the end, tantalizing though that may be. Obviously, we're going to save that for the TV program. But
okay.
The process of the investigation was fascinating, and we had to do a number of things. We had to understand the history of how Lee's farewell address was created, exactly how it was written, who wrote it, were there any other copies written, when was it written, how was it written, on what kind of paper, all of that kind of stuff. We needed to really delve into the details, the nitty-gritty of how it originated. And we then obviously had to look at our document and see how it matched up and see whether it fit the criteria of being the original. And that's the question that the Beech Island Agricultural Club are asking us. They're saying, is this the original copy of Lee's farewell address? And then in addition to investigating that, we needed to establish that the story that the Beech Island Agricultural Club have always told for the last 130-odd years is true. And that revolves around a previous member who is alleged to have worked with Lee and who allegedly Lee gave the original copy to. So we had to trace this guy, a chap called W.H. Atkinson, and find out if his story stood up, if the story about him, how he got hold of the order, was true, basically. So those were the different avenues of the investigation that we looked into.
Did you do anything scientific like test the ink, the paper, that sort of thing?
Well, it was tricky. First of all, the Agricultural Club had encapsulated the paper in plastic. So we could have taken that off, but we felt we didn't need to. We felt actually with this particular document, given the color of it, given one or two other details, that there was enough information without going into scientific analysis. And I think that, coupled with the fact that it was encapsulated, meant that we didn't take that approach in this investigation.
Well, you know, that's interesting. One of the things that our state archives encouraged back in the 60s was this encapsulation, this lamination. And, of course, it can be reversed, but when you reverse the process, there's always the danger of destroying the document itself.
Exactly, and it wasn't a risk we wanted to take.
Well, I'm sure in your course of your investigation, you did some work about the Beech Island Agricultural Society, which was a farmers' organization, planters' organization, founded before the Civil War, that had many famous members, including former Governor James Henry Hammond.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that we thought that was, you know, I don't know if you've been to the Beech Island Agricultural Club, but they have this wall of honor. Basically, whenever any member of the club dies, a photograph of them is permanently put on the wall of the club. And so you walk in there, and there is the history of Beech Island in front of you as soon as you walk into their clubhouse. You see these faces stretching right back to the Civil War and beyond. And as you say, some of them famous, some of them not so well known. But it was an aspect of the story that we loved, the fact that there was a real appreciation of, you know, the history. I think that was a really engaging part of the story for us.
And it's an ongoing organization.
Absolutely.
And actually, we have their older minutes here at the university in our South Carolina library. They're protected here in the permanent collection.
Oh, really?
Yes.
The club obviously holds on to minutes themselves, and so we've managed to go through a lot of those minutes to find out some of the answers to our questions.
Well, tell us a little bit about how you got involved with History Detectives.
I basically was working for Lion Television, who are producing this in the UK. Lion Television is based in the UK. And I was working on another project for the BBC, and this came up, and it was such an exciting opportunity. And I leapt at it, really. And for me, it's a great series. Obviously, I would say that, but I think one of the things that's exciting about it is that it shows that history doesn't just happen in the obvious places. It doesn't just happen in Washington, New York, Dallas, Chicago, wherever. It happens all over the place, and it happens often on, you know, every American's doorstep. And I think one of the things we're trying to show is that we're all connected to big aspects of American history in different ways. And I think as each story comes up, we're finding that to be more and more the case. And making that sort of local connection with big history is a very exciting part of the series.
Well, and that's true. And, of course, here in South Carolina, we would argue that we can connect a lot to the larger story. And this one is one, by the way, I had heard rumors of, but I had never heard the particulars of Lee's farewell address to the Army of Northern Virginia being at Beech Island.
I mean, it's exactly those kind of stories that we're looking to investigate, those kind of rumors that spread around that, you know, you hear from different sources. And we want to come in and see if we can sort of find a little bit of the truth behind those rumors.
Can you tell some of the other stories that you're working on now that are going to be aired in the next few months?
I'd be happy to. We've got some really exciting ones. I think one of the ones that everyone talks about, we have a woman in Wisconsin that has five bullets that she thinks were the bullets that killed Bonnie and Clyde.
Mm-hmm.
We have a man in New England who thinks the whaling ship that he was brought up sort of loving, it was a ship that he sort of heroized, if you can, a ship, and I think inspired him probably to become a sailor himself. The question he wanted to know was it actually an extension of the Underground Railroad? Then we have an incredible story of a woman in New Jersey who found a little pebble on the beach one day as she was out walking. She was looking at it idly, turned it over, and she saw a face carved in the stone, an exquisite little face, clearly very recognizably a face. And the investigation of that and what we discover is probably one of the most amazing discoveries of the whole series. So we've got a few and hopefully a fair variety of stories.
Okay, well, it sounds like you're investigating everything all over the... Now, this is a British production, is that correct?
I mean, Lion Now, it also has an American arm, and we're an American company, so, you know, we're making it exclusively for PBS. So,
okay.
It's very American.
Well, Tony, it sounds like it's fascinating. And you have a series of experts. You've got anthropologists and historians and other people who work with your program. Is that not correct?
That's correct. We have four history detectives, and they all have varying expertises, as you say, from sociology to architecture to general history to antiques and artifacts. And between them and the team, we sort of investigate all the stories as they come in.
Well, this is a fascinating mystery, and it's concerned South Carolina. I'm looking forward to seeing it on air and finding out the resolution.
Well, I hope you enjoy it, and I hope you like what you hear.
Well, we look forward to it, and thanks for being with us today on The Journal.
My pleasure.
This episode of History Detectives will air on SCE TV on Monday, July the 21st at 8 p.m. Next week on Walter Edgar's Journal, I'll be talking with folks who are working to rediscover history. Dorothy Urch was a child on the orphan trains, which, beginning in 1854, relocated thousands of New York City's unwanted and poor children to homes across the country. She'll share her experiences and tell us what she's uncovered about this little-known program. Then I'll talk with Glenn Roberts of Anson Mills in Columbia. They organically grow more than 18 varieties of heirloom rice, corn, and wheat to use for their grits, cornmeal, and other products. I want to thank my guests today, Dorothea Benton Frank, author of Isle of Palms, and Tony Tacoberry, producer of History Detectives. To find out more about the journal, visit us online at walteredgarsjournal.scern.org. Producer and editor of the show is Tiffany Jackson, and I'm your host, Walter Edgar. We hope you have a great weekend.